From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, the alien interviews with L.A. Marzulli. And we are getting really close to Christmas. Here's what's happening. Boy, they are getting battered away in Southern California. Producer Tom Danheiser there tells me it has been a monsoon for the last couple of days. Half a dozen Southern California counties are under an emergency declaration as another powerful storm from the Pacific continues to pummel the region. The governor has warned of a forecast that calls for extraordinary and continuing rainfall that is likely to cause more flooding and landslides. I'll be there soon enough. South Korean automakers Hyundai and Kia, the German and also the German maker Volkswagen, lead the insurance industry's annual list of the safest new vehicles used for safety-minded consumers looking to buy a new car. Hyundai's Genesis sedan, the Sonata midsize, and the Santa Fe Tucson sport utility vehicles picked up awards, while the Kia was recognized for the Optima midsize, the Forte, and the Soul small cars, and also its Sorento. The Volkswagen Jetta and Jetta sports wagon were also tops on the list. Exposure to fluoride may lower children's intelligence, according to a study pre-published in the Environmental Health Perspectives. It's a publication of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. Now, fluoride is added to 70% of the U.S. public drinking supplies, according to Paul Kinnett, PhD and a director of the Fluoride Action Network. Mortgage applications tumbled to their lowest level in nearly a year as a six-week-long rise in interest rates took a huge toll on demand. A finger bone from Siberia now reveals a previously unknown group of ancient humans once existed there, one neither like us or Neanderthals. They call it the DNA from these extinct Siberians seems similar to that of Pacific Islanders. The 30,000-year-old fossil was found in a cave in southern Siberia in 2008, a bone fragment that they think came from the fingertip of a very young girl. The New Zealand military has released hundreds of previously classified objects detailing claims of unidentified flying object sightings and alien encounters. The reports dating from 1954 to 2009 were released Wednesday under the Freedom of Information laws after the New Zealand Defense Force removed names and other identifying material. Incredible stories there. In about 2,000 pages of documents, members of the public, military personnel, and commercial pilots outline close encounters, mostly involving moving lights in the sky. Some of the accounts, including drawings of flying saucers, descriptions of aliens wearing a pharaoh mask, and examples of extraterrestrial writing all over some of those reports. Sci-fi epic Avatar, the most pirated film of 2010. James Cameron's blockbuster was downloaded 16.6 million times on one file sharing site alone. In a moment, Seth Shostak is going to join us. He's the senior astronomer for SETI. We'll be talking about just what's going on in the search for extraterrestrial life. And as you know, we've been talking about this incredible weather, strange patterns, but Robert Felix has always said that we are in the beginning stages of an ice age. He's the author of Not by Fire, but by Ice. You know, today, Robert, a couple more climatologists said that we could be in the beginning of an ice age. And so you're getting backed up.
Oh, I am, George. Thanks for having me on. Yes, and another one that just came out is astrophysicist Piers Corbin in London.
Yes.
Who said that a mini ice age is coming. And I met Piers. I was in London a couple of years ago and spent an evening with Piers, and I just really trust his brilliance and his ability. But yes, you know, parts of England, it has been the coldest in central England since 1659, which all by itself puts us back to little ice age times. So all of this stuff, and you talked about Tom Danheiser being in California and all those floods, and look at Mammoth Mountain, 16 feet of snow in 4 days. And that's two stories of snow in 4 days. That's incredible.
It truly is. What did you see years ago, Robert? We've been talking now for about 13 years. What did you see that made you start reporting on the possibility of the beginning of an ice age?
There is a cycle to ice ages, and I thank you for having me on so many times to talk about it, but there is a cycle to ice ages. This is not something that I made up. This is a cycle that was discovered back in the 1970s. And if all of the global warming proponents would put that cycle, that proven cycle, into their models, we would be preparing for an entirely different scenario.
All right, very good. Thanks, Robert. Robert Felix, not by fire, but by ice. In a moment, Seth Shostak joins us, senior astronomer for SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. We're going to find out just what's new at SETI in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Seth Shostak, senior astronomer for SETI. Now, that Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, noted author as well. Couple books out there, Confessions of an Alien Hunter, Cosmic Company, Sharing the Universe, and Light from the Universe as well. Here he is back on Coast to Coast, a Coast to Coast favorite. Seth, how are you? Ready for Christmas?
I am, George. In fact, I'm on the East Coast where I'm surrounded by snow-covered landscape, so it's looking like Christmas.
Perfect. What's new with SETI, Seth?
Well, I think that the interesting stuff in the past couple of years, past couple of months, let me put it that way, are some experiments that sort of deviate from the usual approach, which is to point our antennas at nearby stars, hoping that they have planets that might have somebody with a radio transmitter on them. We tried some other experiments. There was one that was done over the course of the last month or so called Project Dorothy, as in the Wizard of Oz. And, you know, the reason for the name, it's not happenstance, and it's not because one of the astronomers was named Dorothy. It's because it's been 50 years now since Frank Drake did the first modern SETI experiment, which he called Project Ozma, you know, based on the Frank Baum story of the Wizard of Oz and Princess Oz. It was, a land far away with strange and wonderful beings, so he called his experiment Project Ozma. So this one was called Project Dorothy. The interesting thing about it was it looked at some of the classic star systems that have been looked at in the past, but it involved countries around the world, and that was sort of the first time that's ever been done. So Asia, the United States, Europe, all were involved, and to me that's an important step forward because, you know, SETI is so often just an American experiment.
Seth, as astrophysicists and astronomers begin to find more and more Earth-like planets, does that change the array and the direction that SETI goes after? Do you point toward these planets?
We do, of course. You know, there have been more than 500 planets found around other stars in the last, 15 years, 16 years. And, of course, we look at all those that are within the reach of our telescope. Some of them are very deep in the southern hemisphere, and those we can't reach with a telescope like the Allen Telescope Array. But all the ones that you can actually see, the ones that get above the horizon, of course you look at those. Now, it has to be said that up until now, most of those planets are not really the kind of home ET would want to phone because they tend to be very big planets or they're planets that are very close to their stars, so they're a little bit too toasty. Often they have temperatures, when we know what the temperatures are, of thousands of degrees. So those sound like maybe the wrong worlds. But what's interesting about this line of research is that in the past year, really, the people who do this sort of work looking for these planets have been able to make better estimates of the planets they cannot see, the planets that are more like the Earth. And some recent estimates have been suggesting that, you know, as many as 25% of all stars might have planets more or less the size of Earth. If 1 in 10 of those is really like the Earth, in other words, you know, the same sort of temperatures and so forth, well, that means there are billions of Earths just in our Milky Way. So that's good news. That's good news. It doesn't necessarily determine where you point the antennas, but it's certainly good news.
Physicist Stephen Hawking has said, don't contact ETs. You never know what you're going to summon up here. Be careful. What do you think of that?
Yeah, well, that's a point of view. It's hard to argue with that. I mean, what Hawking was saying is, look, whenever a less advanced society encounters a more advanced, it's usually bad news for the less advanced society. And anybody who studied any history knows that's usually true. So I think what he was saying was, you know, be careful about not necessarily doing SETI. SETI is a passive endeavor. You know, we're just listening. There's no danger there. But if you find a signal, or even if you don't find a signal, and you reply, in other words, you transmit something into space, well, maybe that's not a good idea because you don't know who's out there. And maybe you just alert them and they send their missiles or whatever and, you know, turn the Earth into a charred cinder, which would ruin everybody's whole day. I'm not, you know, losing too much sleep about this, George, because if you really want to worry about this, you have to shut down all the radars, the television, FM radio. Coast to coast would still be okay, but FM radio would go out because that does leak into space. I don't think we want to do that. I mean, and besides, we've been broadcasting since the Second World War anyhow, and any society that, you know, would have the technology to actually threaten us would be able to pick up those signals. That's easy to show. So, you know, if you want to worry about things, this is not one of the things I'd worry about.
And you know, Seth, when the official ET announcement comes, it'll be done on Coast to Coast.
Well, we have a gentleman's agreement about that, I guess. But actually, you know, that's an interesting point because people, you know, ask, well, who would get notified first? But of course, the story would be very messy. You know, there would be indications and then there would be, you know, attempts to verify and so forth and so on. So, yeah, it's going to be a very messy story.
Take us through a scenario, Seth, for a moment. What would it be like when a signal comes in? How would it come in? Would you hear voices? Would you see messages? What would you have?
Yeah, you'd hear voices, but those would be, you know, the people sitting next to you. They'd probably be screaming. We've done this experiment in a sense. I mean, we've occasionally had false alarms, signals that look like they were the real deal. And then it turns out after, you know, a couple hours, sometimes as many as 10 or 15 hours, then you find out, well, no, it's just another satellite causing trouble or whatever, or just a bug in the system. But at least you see what happens when you think you've got the signal. And what happens is that because you're getting signals all the time, you don't get excited right away. But, you know, if this signal persists, if it withstands all the tests that you do for not just 10 minutes, but maybe for an hour, 10 hours, then you begin to do other kinds of tests. Very sensitive test where you move the telescopes around, and eventually, you wouldn't announce it on that basis. What you would do is you would call up somebody in another observatory and have them observe it before you would feel confident about it. But, you know, in the meantime, and we know this is the case, the media are all over it. So, you know, that's what's going to happen. It's just going to be stories in the papers.
One of our favorite movies, yours and mine, the movie Contact. In the way that they found the signal and what they did and things like that. Would we ever get messages like that, instructions to build some kind of a ship?
Well, I mean, you know, who's to say what's on the aliens' minds if they're sending a signal deliberately in our direction? I mean, if they are sending something deliberately to Earth, and that's a question because, you know, we've been broadcasting since the war, but that means that our earliest television signals are only 60 or 70 light years out into space. So that's not very far, you know, on the galactic distance scale, which to me means that it's pretty unlikely anybody knows we're here yet. But let's just assume that for some reason, maybe they are that close, who knows, they are sending something deliberately to us. Well, they're going to put some information into it. They'll also know that, you know, talking back and forth is going to be a slow business if they're, you know, 50, 100 or 500 light years away. So I think they'll send everything at once. What will they send? Who knows? Maybe they'll send us, you know, the canonical sci-fi scenario, you know, build this machine. They do that in a lot of movies. I don't know if they do it in real life. Maybe they would just send us all of physics or, you know, the cure for death. Who knows?
Give us an update of the technology that SETI possesses and what's going on there.
Well, the technology is, you know, always improving, mostly because of the increased speed of computers, which means that you're able to, for one thing, look at more frequency channels at once. In other words, you don't know where on the dial you should be tuning, unlike, you know, for commercial radio or TV or anything where you know where the stations are. We don't know where the station is. So what you try and do to beat that rap is you listen to as many stations at once as you can. If you have faster computers, turns out you can listen to more stations at once. Instead of listening to 50 million channels at once, which is what we were doing 20 years ago, you know, you can listen to 100 million channels or 200 million. All that means is it speeds things up. You can go through the stars faster. You can, you know, it's, if you're looking for a needle in a haystack, it's better to use a shovel than a teaspoon.
Do you man the facility 24/7, or do computers take over? How does that work?
Well, you try and automate all that. I mean, you know, again, the movies tend to simplify the whole story.
I'm picturing a little man sitting there as we speak.
Yeah, yeah, I think that'd be a terrible job. I don't think you'd want to sit there 24/7. I mean, I've done that, you know, and people have done that, where you have to sort of babysit the telescope, and it's okay if you have to do it for a couple of weeks, but, you know, if you had to do it endlessly, I think, you know, you would quickly start slobbering or something. I mean, you know, you couldn't take that. So, of course, you automate all that. And you might think, well, but wait a minute, if you automate it, you know, can you trust the computers? Will they really recognize the signal when they find it? And the answer is, yeah, we think so, because, you know, they're looking for the sorts of things you would look for. And if they get to the point where they say, you know, we've done all the tests we can, not that computers think that way, but, you know, then they, you know, they notify you. They call you up, as it were. They send you an email message, and they say, this signal keeps looking real to me. I don't know what to do anymore. It's up to you, humans. So the computers do the listening, absolutely.
You don't think they would ever become so automated, the computers, that they would say, we're not going to tell SETI what we just heard?
Well, I would be impressed if our software were that clever. I think that would be, that'd be great. If we invent that, then we've really invented our own successors. And the only question to me then is, do they get the Nobel Prize if they succeed?
Seth, you've been at this now for how long? Long time.
I have. I've been at the SETI Institute for 20 years, but I did a SETI experiment in 1981, so that predates even that. And I mentioned before Project Dorothy. That's one of the new projects we've been doing. That celebrates 50 years since Frank Drake did the first SETI experiment, so that was 1960. And people, you know, they often will say, God, 50 years, and you guys still haven't found anything. You know, maybe you should think about being discouraged about this. And, of course, we're not. Because, as I've just said, thanks to the improvements in technology that just keep coming down the pike, the experiment keeps getting faster and faster. So I remain optimistic.
What keeps motivating you? Because you truly have a passion for this.
Well, I think that's a lot of it, the fact that the technology keeps improving. There's something else, and that is that the astronomy keeps turning up things that we didn't know before. I mean, you know, when I first joined the SETI Institute, we didn't even know if there were any planets around other stars. Now we know more than 500 of them. And actually, if you ask people who search for planets, you know, what fraction of stars do you think really have planets? They'll tell you, you know, it could be half, could be three quarters. I mean, that means, you know, hundreds of billions, a trillion planets in the galaxy. Now, we didn't know that. So that's an encouraging sign. We've also learned more about how life works and so forth. We found that there are other planets, even our own solar system, that have water. And so there might even be some sort of life nearby. All these signs in the last 20 years have been pointing in the same direction, namely that, you know, the Earth is just another duck in a row, and it didn't have to be that way. It could have turned out that we were, you know, all the evidence was showing that we were very special, but it doesn't seem to be that way.
Well, you know, it's an incredible effort, I think, and I hope one day we get the kind of signals we want, Seth. And you know what's funny about all of this? I mean, years ago, without sophisticated equipment, we knew, your gut told you, mine told me, that there were other planets out there even before they were discovered. We knew this, didn't we?
Well, we certainly felt that way. I mean, you know, I can't speak for you. I thought that. I mean, I wouldn't take this job if I didn't feel that there was some chance of success, even a good chance of success. But, you know, in science, you have gut feelings, and that motivates an experiment, but then you're dependent on the data. What can you actually show?
See, my gut not only tells me that there are zillions of planets out there, Seth, but there could be millions of worlds and populations inhabited with people and beings much like us. I mean, it's there. You know, we talked once, and it must have been 13 years ago, about the primordial soup in the universe, how it's all the same. And I haven't changed my thoughts about that. Have you?
No, that's another thing that, you know, we have more and more data about. And indeed, you know, the whole universe is built out of the same materials. We've learned that. We learned that quite some time ago, actually. That's kind of old astronomy now. But, you know, we're learning something about some of these planets found around other stars. We haven't found any that are like the Earth. In 700 days, we probably will. NASA's Kepler telescope will tell us, you know, about some Earth-like worlds. So, you know, that's coming down the pike, that's for sure. In another 2 years, we'll know whether they're common or not. But the planets that we've already found, you know, you see that they're not so different from worlds we know about. In other words, again, we're maybe not all that special. And when you say there may be millions of other intelligent species out there, I think you're being too conservative.
Yes, stay with us, Seth. We're going to come right back with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We'll take phone calls. We'll be right back. Well, next hour, it's called The Alien Interviews with Dr. L.A. Marzulli. Get ready for that fascinating program just in store on Coast to Coast AM. When we come back, let's take some phone calls with Seth Shostak from SETI on Coast to Coast AM. Seth, do you allow tours of SETI? And if so, are people like wowed when they get there?
People do tour the place. In general, we don't run organized tours of the Institute. The Institute is located in the Silicon Valley. It's an office building. We just moved to new quarters, actually. It's a pretty nice office building, actually. It's about 2 miles from Google, so anybody knows where Google is. It's just offices. The telescopes, which are located about 300 miles north of San Francisco in the Cascade Mountains, are open during the week if anybody drives by. It's kind of a remote place, but, it's nothing secret there. There's a big sign on the highway, the Hat Creek Radio Observatory. And they can go in, and they'll be happy to. People will be happy to show you around. You can go out and kick the antennas if you like.
Are you done building now? Is the Paul Allen Array finished?
It is not. It is not. The problem here is the usual problem with SETI, and that is funding, finding the money to complete the array. There are 42 antennas now, and operating the telescopes costs $2 million a year, and we have to get that from private funding, and that's a big challenge for us.
What's the goal? How many antennas would you like?
Well, the immediate goal is to get it above 100. 200 is much better. At 200, it's absolutely a competitive world-class radio astronomical telescope. The design goal is 350. So, wow. It just requires somebody who sees the value in doing this kind of research to come forward with the money. It's not being built with government money.
Did the economy hurt even someone like Paul Allen?
I think it does. I think anybody who's in the nonprofit sphere, and of course the SETI Institute is a nonprofit research organization, has felt the effects of the downward economy. You would think that very wealthy people would say, well, obviously I still have a lot of money,
sure.
But of course they look at their investments and they're down by 30 or 40% or whatever it is, and they reduce the amount of money that they give to what they consider worthwhile causes. So yeah, it hurts. It does hurt.
Let's go to Portland, Oregon. Ray is with us west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Ray.
Hello.
Hey,
thanks, you
welcome.
Guys. I love your program.
Thank you.
During a solar eclipse, the moon is between the sun and the earth. And during a lunar eclipse, the earth is between the sun and the moon. And from Earth, a human viewing the eclipse sees either body as the same diameter as the sun. You see on the moon the shadow, the same diameter that the earth casts is the same diameter as the moon. And from the earth, you see the moon passing between the sun. The moon is the same diameter as the sun, exactly. And I want to know, is this a property of the harmonic nature of matter as it vibrates through orbits and physical reality in our galaxy? Or is this a phenomenon associated only with Earth, and would that attract extraterrestrials to our planet as an observatory of sorts?
Well, Ray, an interesting question. I think that the real answer is behind curtain number three, namely that it's a bit of a coincidence. Actually, if you were on the moon looking at the Earth, it looks bigger than the sun. But you are right that during a solar eclipse, the moon gets in front of the sun and it just covers it. It just covers it, and that's kind of interesting because the sun is actually about 400 times the diameter of the moon, but on the other hand, the moon is about 400 times closer to us than the sun. So it just works out, and you might say, man, is it some sort of harmonic, convergence of some sort? Well, you can say that, but I think it's just coincident. We just lucked out, which is great for people who organize tours to solar eclipses. It's kind of nice. I once tried to find any other moons, because there are hundreds of moons in our solar system, and I tried to find another situation where the moon, as seen from its planet, would just cover the sun, so they could have total solar eclipses too. One of the moons of Jupiter comes pretty close, but it's kind of a cruddy moon. It's probably not very round. And besides, living on Jupiter's kind of a gas, but not very pleasant.
Seth, what would we look like from the outside looking in? And not just the pictures that astronauts took of us, but I mean to other civilizations, if they were able to see the sun, the moon, parts of the Earth, and a few other planets. It's got to be magnificent, don't you think?
Well, it depends on, you know, what kind of telescopes they have. I mean, you know, assuming that they're hundreds of light years away, and the nearest intelligent species might be that far, then, you know, it takes a pretty big telescope just to see the Earth as a dot. This is the pale blue dot, as Carl Sagan described it. But, you know, they would have other instruments. A couple of things would strike them. The sun is just, you know, a ho-hum star. I mean, it's, you know, it's bigger than some, smaller than some others. Nothing terribly special about the sun that we know about. The Earth, however, will be a little bit special because, to begin with, it has a different color. It's blue. But beyond that, well, that tells them something, that there might be some water here. Also, if they just watched it for 24 hours, they would see the brightness change because of clouds, you know, going around as the Earth rotates. The thing that might strike them the most is that there's oxygen in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's not very hard for any aliens who have the budget to build a big optical telescope to find. And if they can do that, then they know with some degree of certainty that, you know, I don't know, Zork, much about that planet down there, but clearly it has, you know, plants or something. It's got photosynthesis. It's got something that's producing oxygen. So that would be a clue that Earth has life.
Let's go to Westchester County, New York, on the wildcard line. Travis is there. Hey, Travis, go ahead.
Yeah, Travis. Good evening, George.
Hi.
Seth, I want to ask you a question. My people of the Disclosure Project and MUFON, most of MUFON, will testify under oath that we have been visited and we continue to be visited, and they will sign affidavits. They talk about seeing ET bodies. The astronauts have seen them. There was conversations heard. Now, I can go more into details, but let me ask you this. We also back-engineered some technology from the aliens. The thing is, will you, your people, the mainstream astronomers, testify under oath before an almighty God and citizens of the world that we've never been visited? Would you sign affidavits to that so-called fact? Because we are really annoyed. We've been annoyed for a long time. And Stanton Friedman is the wrong person for you to debate these issues with. When you really should be debating this issue with Dr. Stephen Greer and his people as an example.
Well, I have.
I don't know if he can sign an affidavit that says we've never been visited, because he will tell you he doesn't know. But go ahead, Seth.
Yeah, well, exactly. To begin with, Travis, I appreciate your enthusiasm there. Obviously, I can't say that we've never been visited. I mean, maybe the aliens came 100 million years ago and collected some dinosaurs and then left. I mean, how could I possibly know that? They may have visited during the time of the trilobites. It's true. I don't think that the evidence that we're being visited now is very good. But I point out something that you, I'm sure, know, and that is that science is not done by people signing affidavits. That's, you know, we didn't decide that Einstein was right because he signed an affidavit. What happened is that you just do a bunch of experiments, you accumulate the evidence, and you say, you know, this evidence is pretty darn convincing. Let's try another experiment. Gosh, it works out too. That's the nature of science. I mean, it's and I've said many times on this show, Travis, that it's not impossible that we could have been visited. But if you think that's the case, then you have to make the case. You just have to, you know, publish it in refereed journals and get the Smithsonian to show the evidence or whatever. And I think you'd get more attention. And by the way, I actually did debate Stephen Greer on the radio once, quite some time ago, but I have done it.
Some people think that SETI's holding back information, Seth. They think that they have picked up signals, intelligence signals, and they're not telling anyone. I think Stephen thinks that too, Stephen Greer. I don't. I truly believe if we picked it up, you guys would have been telling us a long time ago.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I know that Greer has said that. He said that on Coast. And I tried to get hold, yes, of his office to find out, you know, when did that happen? With whom did he talk? And, of course, I got nowhere with that. But, no, the facts are that, to begin with, there's no policy of secrecy in SETI. And SETI, by the way, is done by several different groups. There's a group at Harvard. There's a group at the University of California, Berkeley. There's a group in South Korea. There's a group in Italy. So it isn't just one experiment. But there's no policy of secrecy. I mean, if you find a signal, you know, there's nothing that would improve your situation faster and better than to find evidence of a signal. Then suddenly all this discussion about, you know, how's the funding situation? mean, that doesn't become an issue at all. But I can tell you that the people that run the experiments were have never been told, if you find a signal, keep it secret. We know that's the case because on those occasions when we've had false alarms, you know, the New York Times is calling us up. They learn about it within hours. They know about it within hours.
There's always a source.
Well, exactly. Well, what people are doing is they're just sending
WikiLeaks.
Emails.
WikiLeaks, you're everywhere.
Well, we don't even try and keep it quiet, so that makes it even easier.
It's Bill Stern in West Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi, Seth. Hi. I'm an amateur astronomer, and I have two quick, great questions for you. Question number one, the NASA spacecraft Kepler that was launched in 2009, and now it's almost 2011. Question number one, when will Kepler come out with its total data that hopefully will show that there are potentially hundreds of Earth-sized planets in the habitable zones of their parent stars? And question number two, the NASA has on its drawing board an unmanned mission to go to Jupiter called Europa Jupiter System Mission, which will orbit Europa, the moon Europa, that may have ocean underneath the ice with life underneath it. My question specifically, question number two, will it have a lander, hopefully, that could drill through the ice and examine it with a submarine and examine if there's life underneath the oceans of Europa?
Okay, well, Bill, let me just take the second one first because I want to spend just a little bit more time on the first one. You know, the first mission to Europa probably will not have a lander. That's, again, a question of money. All these things tend to be a question of money. You could design a lander, people have, but it's much more expensive to build the lander. So what they will do the first time is that they will orbit Europa or at least pass by it closely with radars that can penetrate the ice a little bit, low-frequency radars, because Europa, which is a moon about the same size as our own moon, is covered with ice, probably 10 miles thick. And underneath that, there's this vast ocean with twice as much water as on the Earth. So the question is, are there any thin spots? Because you if you want to send something there that lands and drills a hole and looks for Europans underneath, you want to do it in a thin spot, right? You don't want to have to drill through 10 miles of ice if you can avoid it, if you can find a place where it's only 1 mile deep, for example. So that's what they would do there. As far as is the Kepler mission, yeah, that's one of the most exciting things going, I think, because what they're looking for are, you know, cousins of the Earth. And if you were looking for the Earth, you know, if you were an alien, you had a Kepler telescope 100 light years away and looking at the sun, you know, you'd see the sun got dimmer by 0.01% for a couple hours. And then 365 days later, it got dimmer again by the same amount. And then 365 days after that, you saw it a third time. You say, you know what? There's a planet there that's orbiting every 365 days. And because of how much dimming it caused, I know it's how big it is. It's, you know, 8,000 miles in diameter, whatever the Earth is. Well, that's exactly what Kepler's looking for, and it also has to see three cases of dimming before you would be convinced. That's why it takes 3 years for Kepler to come out with this, you know, the answer to this question. What fraction of stars have worlds like the Earth? So it's another, you know, year and a half, 2 years, another 700 days, you'll know the answer, Bill. And, you know, the smart money is saying they're going to find, you know, 30, 40, 50 Earth-like worlds. If that's the case, that means there are billions of them in the galaxy.
Let's go next to San Diego, California. First-time caller, Gary, you are on Coast to Coast. Hi, Gary.
Hey, George. Good evening. Great show you got there going. Hello, Seth.
Hi, Gary.
Say, my question is for Seth and the observations that are being done with the radio telescopes. Is there anything being tracked as far as movement, like instantaneous movement across the skies? I've seen a couple of instances of what appear to be like a shooting star. You know, that type of movement has caught my eye, but yeah, it's gone all the way across the sky. One time I was in the back of a pickup truck coming back from Wyoming, and I was watching the stars, and what looked like a shooting star went, I'm going to guess, probably 100 degrees across my field of view and instantly stopped. And then it instantly started up again at a perfect 90 degree angle. Hmm. and went, you know, maybe a couple inches straight up across the sky and stopped again, instantly stopping the whole time, maintained a light intensity the same as that as a star. And once it stopped, you know, I continued to focus on it until finally I couldn't tell which one it was anymore from the bouncing around in the back of the vehicle.
Yeah, well, Gary, I can't explain what that is. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of satellites. There are thousands of satellites. These are around the Earth, okay? And, you know, they take, 10 minutes or something like that to cross the sky, as much of it as you're going to see. And, there are certain times of the day. At midnight, you won't see these things, but you will see them, after sunset or before sunrise more frequently. They don't change direction and suddenly go at 90 degrees, so that's the mystery here. We don't track that sort of stuff. Our equipment is not designed to really, watch things that move that far that fast in general. But the military has, of course, well, NORAD, but, they track this stuff, this space junk, which is a big problem, of course, for the space program. You don't want to launch rockets into space and have it hit something the size of a dime or even an aspirin, because that would just destroy the... would destroy the vehicle and probably kill whoever's aboard, if there's anybody aboard. So they do track things. Now, they can only track stuff that's about the size of a baseball or larger, if it's a couple hundred miles up. I don't know what that was, what you're talking about. We don't track that stuff, so I can't help you there.
Seth, would you be surprised, would you be shocked, if you truly found an incredible signal?
Well, I'll tell you, again, we've had these false alarms, and they give you some idea of what it would be like if it happened. And I don't know whether I was shocked. I was, I was just so dismayed. I was so discombobulated, I think is the best adjective I can think of, because, you've got your whole week planned, and now suddenly everything's out the window, and you don't quite know what's going to happen. All you know is that you're not going to be getting a whole lot of sleep for a while.
Okay, let's go to New York. Alex is with us on the Wild Card Line. Hello, Alex. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about SETI and SETI-like organizations.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering if you or they passively listen for signals from other star systems, or do any of them actively ping other star systems, sending out a signal?
Yeah, it's a good question, Alex. It's a good question. And the answer is, well, we've only been listening, but there have been a few pings, not many, particularly compared to, the BBC or ABC or NBC or any of them, because they're pinging all the time in a way.
And what does he mean by ping?
He means that I assume he means that we transmit, trying to elicit a response. In other words, we say, hi, we're the Earthlings. We're here. Send us a return message.
Okay.
That's what you mean, Alex, right? Alex is gone.
Go ahead.
Okay, but in general, we don't do that. Now, the reason we don't do that is largely because it costs money to do that, too. So if you only have money to do one experiment, the advantage of listening is that, you might succeed tonight. Whereas if you ping and the aliens are, say, 500 light years away, well, you got to have a lot of patience before you're ever going to hear anything, even assuming they answer your ping. But there has been, in the past couple of years, sort of a growing group of people who are interested in doing that pinging. It's called active SETI. And, it generates a lot of emotional response. Some people think you shouldn't do it. Some people think you should do it. One of the arguments for doing it is that it might just give you a whole lot of insight as to how you might do the listening better. If you're confronted with a problem of actually transmitting to another star, you might understand the alien's problem better, and you might do a better job in listening.
Seth, is there still media interest in SETI?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, people are interested in aliens. Fortunately, Hollywood keeps cranking out the movies in which aliens play leading roles. Usually they're the heavies, it seems. No, people are interested. And as I say, there are all these developments in science that all seem to point in the same direction, namely that life is probably not confined to this planet. That would be remarkable. I mean, it just worked out here how many planets like the Earth there probably are in our galaxy, and it's more than the number of trees in the United States. So, we're a couple of owls sitting in this tree wondering if there are any other owls in the United States,
If people want more information on SETI, Seth, what do they do?
Well, go to the SETI Institute's website. It's just SETI.org. That's all they have to type into their browser, SETI.org.
All right. Seth, you have a great holiday. And thank you again for everything you've been doing over the years here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie, and I'll be back in a moment with Dr. L.A. Marzulli as he talks about the alien interviews.